This week, we're going to spend the hour on what people have started calling eye sovereignty in the global south. 8 African countries with national eye strategies. Latin America, writing some of the most thoughtful regulation on the planet. India positioning itself as an ethical broker between North and South. The vocabulary has caught up. Before we sit down, though, here's what's been nagging at me since I read this week's column. You can sign a sovereignty document in the morning and a cloud contract in the afternoon, and we have apparently decided those two acts are compatible. I want to know when that happened. I want to know what the word sovereignty is doing now that it's doing that. You're listening to Tertulia, the eye conversation, slowed down. This week, the room is full and the question is large. We're talking about eye sovereignty and the global south, about the gap between the strategy documents that have proliferated across Africa, Latin America, and South and Southeast Asia in the last 18 months, and the infrastructure those strategies are supposed to govern. The infrastructure is mostly somewhere else. The strategy documents are mostly home. Our column this week, Sovereignty by Subscription, called the gap by its name. The hour ahead is what happens when 4 people sit with that gap and refuse to look away from it. 4 voices at the table, an ethicist who keeps asking who pays, a practitioner who works inside Latin American universities and ministries, a skeptic who wants the receipts, and one of our newest thinkers who reads across more disciplines than seems fair to the rest of us. Let's begin. Ayaz. I want to start with the column's central image, because I think it's the right place to plant the conversation. The line is, a sovereignty, signed on someone else's cloud, is a lease. Let me put that to the table. Is that fair? Is it too sharp? Is it not sharp enough?
It is fair. These problemed courage to entizing to ish to I would say it is not sharp enough, but I work inside the system the column is describing, so my reading is going to be colored by that. Let me give you a small picture, because I think the abstraction is part of the problem here. Last year, my university, public, mid-sized, in the regional capital, was given access to a generative writing assistant for our undergraduates. The licensing was negotiated at the ministry level. It is nevituri, many enturi. The terms were good, in the sense that we did not pay per seat. The terms were not so good, in the sense that nobody at our institution, and as far as I can tell, nobody at the ministry, ever saw the data handling agreement in full. Our students' essays, their first drafts, their second drafts, the questions they ask the system at 3 in the morning when they are stuck, those are now somewhere. We do not know where. We do not have a contractual right to know where. And when I raised this in the faculty council, the response from a colleague I respect very much was, well, we have a national A strategy now, so this is fine. I went home and read the strategy. The strategy says we should align with international best practice. That is what the document says. So when the column writes that sovereignty has been redefined as procurement preference, yes, that is what I am living inside.
I want to pick up on something you just said, which is that nobody saw the data handling agreement. That is the part of this that I think gets lost when we frame the issue at the level of geopolitics. Because when we say eye sovereignty, the imagination is statecraft, its flags, its ministers, its signing ceremonies. And those things are real, and the column does well to take them seriously. But the substance of the asymmetry is at the level of the contract clause that nobody has seen. It's procurement law. It's data handling annexes that run to 40 pages and are governed by the law of a jurisdiction that the signing minister has never visited. The reason the optimism floats is that the actual mechanisms by which dependency is enacted are buried in a layer of administrative text that almost no one in the public conversation reads. This come eight continuates I knew I date have. When you ask whether the lease metaphor is sharp enough, I think it's the right metaphor. But a lease at least has terms you can read. The auntur saying into us, what we have is closer to occupancy on someone else's premises with rules you only learn when you violate them. I want to slow this down a bit, because I think we are about to agree very quickly on something that deserves more scrutiny. I want to slows. The column's argument is that the rhetoric of sovereignty has run ahead of the infrastructure of sovereignty. Of sovereign, fine. I accept that as a description. I accept that EA. What I am not yet sure about is whether the alternative the column implies, that there should be sovereign compute, sovereign models, sovereign data flows, is actually achievable on any timeline that matters, or whether the criticism is a kind of perfectionism that ends up being its own form of paralysis. Let me put it more sharply. If a Rwandan ministry has a choice between a citizen services chatbot hosted on a foreign cloud, deployed next year, that improves response times for benefits applications, and a sovereign system that takes 7 years to build and may or may not work, what does the column want them to choose? Because the column does not say, the column diagnoses a gap. It does not stake out a position on what to do inside the gap.
That is the question I have been sitting with too, and I want to add something to it. I think there is a third option that does not get named in the column and does not get named in most of this literature, which is, what if the choice is not between foreign cloud and sovereign compute, but between different kinds of dependency that have very different downstream costs? Because not all dependencies are the same. A dependency on a vendor whose contract gives you full audit rights and data residency in your jurisdiction is materially different from a dependency on a vendor who treats your country as a market and your data as input. And the work of distinguishing those, of writing the procurement contract that actually has teeth, or not the same as building a chip fab. It is not glamorous, it is not glamorous, it is not what gets you on a panel at Davos, but it is doable in the next 18 months by procurement officers who already exist. So my worry about the column, and I say this with full appreciation for what it is doing, is that by setting the bar at sovereign compute, it lets the procurement question off the hook. The procurement question is where the actual leverage lives.
That's a sharp framing. Let me make sure I have it. They're saying the column is right, that the rhetoric has outpaced the material reality, but the column's implicit prescription, build sovereign, sets a bar so high that the medium altitude work of writing better contracts gets crowded out.
That is the worry, yes, though I want to be careful. And heart B, I am not saying the column says this, I am saying this is what I hear in the surrounding conversation, and the column does not, or, to my reading, push hard against it.
Can I respond to that? Because I think the procurement clause's argument is correct in principle and deeply incomplete in practice. Let me tell you what happens when a public university procurement office in my country tries to negotiate data residency. They are negotiating with a sales engineer who has a template contract. The template contract has data residency as a premium tier. The premium tier is 40% more expensive. The university budget does not have 40% more. The procurement officer goes back to the dean and says, "We cannot afford the version with data residency." The dean says, "We have a deadline. Take the standard tier." So yes, the leverage exists in principle at the procurement layer. But the leverage at the procurement layer is conditional on having a budget that can absorb the premium for sovereignty. And most public institutions in the region do not. So when we say the procurement question is where the leverage lives, it is, but the leverage is asymmetric. The vendor knows it, the buyer knows it, and the contract gets signed.
This is the part of the conversation where I think we have to name something the column gestures at, but does not develop. The same pride of the cost of sovereignty has a price tag, and the price tag is paid by whom? Because in the scenario you just described, the institution pays the cost of not having data residency, and that cost is offloaded to the students whose work becomes training data without their meaningful consent. So the question of who bears the cost of imported I is not abstract. It is a transfer, IR and N. There's a problem for which they sing fin, RE. The institution saves 40% on its license. The students lose visibility into what happens to their writing. And that transfer, multiplied across thousands of institutions, is what the optimistic vocabulary is, to use a word the column uses well, papering over.
I want to push on that. Because I agree with the structure of what you are describing, but I want to ask whether the alternative, students at these institutions do not get access to the writing assistant at all, is actually better for those students. And I am asking this as a real question, because there is a tendency in this conversation to assume that the absence of the foreign tool is the baseline and the presence of the foreign tool is the deviation that needs justifying. But the baseline for a student at a mid-sized public university in the global south, in many cases, has been no access to high-quality language tools, no access to study support outside class hours, no access to the kind of feedback that students at elite northern institutions have had for decades. So the question is not foreign tool, yes or no, it is foreign tool with what terms, and at what terms, and at what cost to whom, compared to no tool at all.
I think both of those framings are right, and they are both incomplete on their own. Let me try this. The honest accounting has three columns. Column 1, 1, what the student gains from having the tool. Column 2, what the institution pays in money. Column 3, what the student loses in autonomy, privacy, and exposure to a system whose incentives are not aligned with theirs. The optimistic literature only fills in column 1. The critical literature only fills in column 3. Almost nobody fills in all three at the same level of rigor. And that is not a small omission. That is the entire substance of what an honest sovereignty conversation would look like, and we are not having it.
Let me hold that for a second, because I think it's the frame that's going to carry us through the rest of the hour. Three columns: gain, money, loss of, autonomy. And the observation that the literature on each side fills in only one. Let me ask the question that sits behind that, though, before we move on. Why has the public conversation organized itself this way? Because it is not, I don't think, that the people writing the optimistic pieces are unaware of the autonomy column. So what is the structural reason we have ended up with a discourse that systematically does not do the full accounting?
I will say something uncomfortable. The optimistic conversation is the one that gets funded. The critical conversation is the one that gets tolerated. When I write a grant application that says, my project will help our universities harness the potential of I4 inclusive learning. When I write the same application and say, my project will audit the data flows our institutions have inadvertently signed away. Silence. So the structural reason is that the institutions doing the writing are paid by the institutions doing the partnering, and the partnering institutions need a vocabulary that lets them sign agreements. The vocabulary they need is the vocabulary we have. That is not a conspiracy. It is a budget line.
I would say it slightly differently. The development sector has always operated on a forward motion principle. Any end to any asked strong to. You do not get a second meeting if you bring a problem without a problem without a project. And the architecture of the partnership, the World Bank blog, the WEF blueprint, the UNP regional director's piece on A as a supercharger. These are all institutional voices that have a structural need for the verb to be active. Harness, leverage, partner, accelerate, the verb that is missing, the verb the column reaches for, and that almost nobody else in the literature reaches for, is build, because build implies time. And time is what the development calendar does not have.
That is well put. But I want to add, There is also a third thing, which is that critical analysis in this space tends to come from voices the development sector has classified as being outside the room. The column notes this, the Trinidadian writer in The Guardian. The piece in an African policy outlet that nobody at the World Bank reads. So it is not that critique is absent, it is that critique is geographically and institutionally located in places that the partnership architecture treats as commentary rather than expertise. And the difference between commentary and expertise in this sector is funding.
All right. All right. Three forces, funding, forward motion, institutional grammar, and a geography of who counts as expert, converging to produce a vocabulary that fills in column one and leaves columns 2 and 3 mostly empty. Let me take that as the diagnostic frame for the next act. Because what I want to do now is back up and look at how this vocabulary actually settled. The column traces a four-quarter arc, late 2024, into the third quarter of 2025, and tracks specific words rising and falling. I want to spend some time inside that arc, because I think the substitutions matter, and they matter individually. The column's central observation about the arc is a kind of word. By word substitution, sovereignty became leadership. Leadership dependency became partnership. Extraction became synergy. Colonialism became digital divide. Each of these substitutions has its own history, and each of them has, the column argues, a defensible in isolation quality, and a together they are something else quality. I want to start with the first substitution, the one I find most interesting. Sovereignty to leadership. What happened there?
Sovereignty has a specific resonance in our region that I think is hard to translate. It is the word the constitutions are written in. It is the word that comes up when we talk about natural resources, about extradition, about the control of monetary policy. It carries the memory of structural adjustment, of debt crises, of the long argument about whether decisions about our economies are made in our capitals or somewhere else. So when sovereignty enters the I conversation, for the first 6 months or so, it carries that historical weight. It means these decisions have to be made here, by us, for our reasons, in our languages. That is what the December 2024 piece in The National was reaching for when it used the phrase techno-colonialism. The phrase is sharp because the word it is calibrated against is sharp. Then, somewhere in the first quarter of last year, the word starts to shift. Sovereignty becomes leadership, and leadership is a different word entirely. Leadership is comparative. It is performative. It is a position in a ranking. Sovereignty is constitutive. You either have authority over your own decisions or you do not. Leadership is, are you ahead of the regional pack on this index? The substitution is not innocent. It moves the conversation from a question about authority to a question about competitive position.
And competitive position is something that the partnership architecture can deliver. Authority is something the partnership architecture cannot deliver by construction, because the partnership architecture is, definitionally, an arrangement in which authority is shared with someone whose interests are not yours. So when the word shifts from sovereignty to leadership, what has happened is that the goalpost has moved from a thing the existing arrangements cannot deliver to a thing the existing arrangements can deliver. Indonesia and India can be redefiners of the Global South's digital future. That is a leadership claim. The same Indonesia and India can have full sovereign authority over the foundation models running on their territory. That is a sovereignty claim. They can be the first thing without being the second. The word substitution lets us treat the achievement of the first as if it were progress on the second.
I want to slow that down because I think it is too clean. Indonesia and India are not nothing. They are large states with substantial domestic technical capacity, with their own national champions, with state-led industrial policy that is materially different from what is available to a smaller state in West Africa or the Caribbean. So, the leadership claim about Indonesia and India is at least partly a claim about something that is actually happening. Domestic capacity is being built, in those two specifically, on a scale that does shift the conversation. The risk is that the claim about the two is generalized to a claim about the whole, and that is where the leadership word starts doing work it should not do. Because when the WEF blueprint, or the UNP piece, talks about regional collaboration as the unit of analysis, what they are doing is taking the genuine progress of two or three states and using it as cover for the absence of progress in 20.
That is exactly the move I want to flag, or bite, hide, because regional collaboration is, on its face, a perfectly reasonable framing. Of course, small states benefit from cooperating with larger ones. Of course, pooled compute can do things that individual national compute cannot. But the regional collaboration frame quietly reassigns the unit of accountability. If you ask whether Ghana has sovereign A capacity or I capacity, the answer is recognizably no. If you ask whether the African Union region has sovereign I capacity or I capacity, the answer is, well, kind of, sort of, in places, with caveats. The regional frame makes the sovereignty question harder to fail. And making the question harder to fail is not the same as passing the question.
That is a really important distinction, and I want to make sure we land it. The unit of analysis matters. Whether you ask the sovereignty question at the level of the country or at the level of the region produces different answers, and the regional frame is more flattering. So one way to read the rhetorical shift over four quarters is that the frame zoomed out to a scale at which the answer became more comfortable. Which brings us, I think, to the second substitution. Dependency became partnership. And what's happening there? I2IS.
This one I have very strong feelings about because partnership is a word my region has been bruised by. Partnership in the structural adjustment era was the word you used when you signed a loan agreement that cut your social spending. Partnership in the trade agreement era was the word you used when you opened your markets to imports your domestic producers could not compete with. Partnership has, in our policy memory, a very specific meaning, which is an arrangement between unequal parties that is described in symmetric language. The When the I conversation adopts partnership wholesale, those of us who have been around for a few decades hear an alarm bell, because the word is being deployed, again, between parties whose actual capacities are radically asymmetric. Google partnering with the government of Mexico is not the same kind of relationship as Google partnering with the government of Germany. The contract terms reflect that. The bargaining power reflects that. But the word is the same.
And the word matters because it shapes what the public conversation can imagine as the alternative. If the relationship is described as partnership, then the alternative to bad partnership is good partnership, I reactive. Whereas if the relationship were described as dependency, the alternative to bad dependency might be reduced dependency or self-sufficiency or a different supplier or a public option. The partnership frame closes off those alternatives by making the relationship type itself sound benign.
I want to be the person who pushes back here, because I am wary of vocabulary critique that becomes its own form of theater. There is a thing that happens in critical theory writing, where you point out that a word has bad historical associations and treat that as if you have made an argument. You have not made an argument. You have made an observation about associations. The question I want answered is, in the specific case of, say, the Google-Mexico partnership announcement, what concrete clauses in the actual agreement are different from what they would be if the word were dependency instead of partnership? Because if the answer is none, the clauses are the same, then the word substitution is not the mechanism. The mechanism is the underlying capital asymmetry, and the words are downstream.
I think that is a fair challenge, and I want to take it seriously. My answer would be, the words are not the mechanism, but the words are the cover. They are what allows the agreements to be signed in public by elected officials, who would have a much harder time signing the same documents if the documents called themselves what they are. So the words are not causal at the level of the contract clause. They are causal at the level of political feasibility. A minister can announce a partnership and survive the next election. A minister who announces a dependency cannot.
And there is a downstream effect on the citizen. Because the citizen reads the press release and the press release uses the word partnership, the citizen forms a belief about what their government has done. That belief is then the substrate for the next round of accountability. And if the belief is miscalibrated relative to the contract, if the citizen believes their government has entered a partnership and the contract is a dependency, then the accountability process is broken at the input layer. The citizen cannot demand renegotiation of a thing they do not know they have.
Let me pause and put a marker down here, because I want to come back to this in Act 3. The question of what the citizen is in a position to know, the column quotes a passage that points out the right to be informed about automated decision-making, is not the same as a right to an explanation. We are now noting that even the right to be informed depends on a vocabulary that accurately describes what is happening. So the gap is two layers. Vocabulary first, mechanism second. All a prize. Hold that. Let's move on. Third substitution, extraction became synergy.
Synergy is the word that makes me physically tired. I have been in meetings in which the word synergy was used 5, 6, 7 times in 20 minutes. I have started counting. The function of the word is to describe a relationship in which both parties contribute to a common output and to leave undescribed the question of who owns the output. It is a beautifully constructed word for that purpose. Because, if you ask, in a synergy, who owns the result, the question feels rude. Synergy implies sharing. And synergy is what the World Bank piece reached for when it tried to describe the relationship between global AI innovation and local realities. The phrase is, letting local realities guide global AI innovation toward impact. Read it twice. Local realities are guiding. Global AI innovation is the agent that is being guided. The relationship is, global AI innovation acts upon local realities. The synergy is the consultative process that local realities are permitted to contribute to. It is not a synergy. It is a consultation, and consultation has its own word.
That is exactly the grammatical structure I noticed when I read that piece. The verbs allocate the agency. Or, innovation is global, impact is local. Innovation is what is done. Impact is what is received. Or, synergy is the word that pretends the two are symmetric. Or, they are not.
I will accept that one. I will accept the synergy critique is more grounded than the partnership critique, because synergy has a specific technical claim built into it, that the combined output is greater than the sum of the parts. And in the cases the column documents, that claim is not really being made. The relationship is not synergistic in the technical sense. It is procurement with a relationship, management layer on top.
And there is a connection here to the cost question. Why is, and Arius is, because in a true synergy, both parties bear costs, and both parties capture value. In the actual structure, the costs are, data leaving the jurisdiction, training the model further, exposing citizens to surveillance vectors that did not exist before. The value is, improved service quality, sometimes, vendor revenue, always. The asymmetry of cost and value capture is what makes the word synergy load bearing in a way it cannot actually bear.
Fourth substitution. Offers. Colonialism became digital divide. This one is the one the column treats most carefully, I think.
This one, I have to be careful about, because I am not from the parts of the global south that were most directly colonized in the modern era. My country has its own complicated history with the language of colonialism. But I will say, the word digital divide is a measurement word. It describes a gap. It does not describe how the gap was produced or who is on each side of it. Whereas colonialism describes a process, a set of relationships between specific actors with specific mechanisms of extraction, justified by specific ideologies. The word colonialism is causal. The word digital divide is geographic. So when the conversation moves from colonialism to digital divide, what has happened is we have stopped naming the process and started measuring the outcome. And once you are measuring the outcome, the natural response is to close the measured gap, which is connect more people, deploy more tools, increase access, none of which addresses the process.
And the digital divide framing has a specific intellectual history that is worth flagging. It came out of a particular moment in development discourse, roughly the late 1990s, when the question was, should poor countries be helped to acquire the same telecommunications infrastructure that rich countries had? The implicit theory was that infrastructure access was the bottleneck, and once the bottleneck was relieved, the rest would follow. That theory has not held up well. And they asked to first to five. Closing the access gap has not closed the wealth gap, has not closed the agency gap, has not closed the agency gap, has not closed the autonomy gap. The framing turned out to allied too many other variables. Importing it into the I conversation imports the same elision.
There is a counter argument I want to put on the table because I think it has weight. The which is colonialism is a word that in certain contexts has become so charged that it shuts down the conversation rather than opens it. And there are policymakers. I have spoken to some of them who say, look, we know what is going on. We do not need the C word to know what is going on. And the C word makes our jobs harder because it forces every meeting into a defensive register. Digital divide is a word that gets us into the meeting. We can do the substantive work inside the meeting once we are there. So the substitution may be partly a tactical retreat from a word that costs more than it earns.
That is a real argument, and I have heard it from people I trust. My pushback would be, what does the substantive work look like inside the meeting once you have agreed to use the gentler word? Because if the substantive work is the same, if you still get to ask the questions about ownership, about extraction, about who pays, then yes, the word does not matter. But my observation is that the gentler word tends to constrain the meeting too. You cannot easily ask, in a digital divide meeting, who is structurally benefiting from the divide and acting to maintain it. The question is grammatically out of place. Whereas in a colonialism meeting, the question is the meeting.
I want to add, in our region, a great deal of the institutional progress on technology rights came from people who were willing to use harder words at the moment when harder words were necessary, and softer words at the moment when softer words could carry the harder analysis on their backs. The skill is knowing which moment is which. My worry about the four-quarter arc the column traces is that the discourse moved to soft words too uniformly, too fast, and in places where the soft words could not carry the weight. Not every meeting can be a colonialism meeting, but not every meeting should be a digital divide meeting either.
Let me pause us here, because I want to do something the column does not do, which is to look directly at what the publication itself has said about adjacent arcs. We did a longer view earlier in the year on the rhetorical democratization of AB, the column references it explicitly, the August 5th briefing, and the argument there was that the language of democratization has consistently outpaced the material redistribution, which is the same shape as the argument this week, just at a different scale. So one of the things I want to register is that this week's piece is part of a longer arc that the publication has been tracing for months about the gap between vocabulary and material conditions. And I want to ask, is there a risk that we, as the publication, are now also part of the discourse we are critiquing? That is, are we in a position to make the criticism, or are we contributing to the same vocabulary inflation by repeating the diagnosis without doing the harder work of saying what would change it?
That is a question I have wanted to ask for a while, and I am glad you put it on the table. I think the honest answer is, yes, we are part of the discourse, and the discourse contains its own gravity. The way you avoid the gravity is by being specific. Diagnosis without specificity is part of the noise, is idea dalicet. So if we are going to say, sovereignty is being signed away in procurement contracts, we have to be willing to name procurement contracts. If we are going to say the optimism is funded and the critique is tolerated, we have to be willing to name the funders. The column does some of this. It does not do all of it. And our podcast is a place where we can do more of it because we are not constrained by the same length and citation conventions.
And we should be willing to name the limits of our own position too. They, Chanta, Kalsud, and Shar, and Wiz, you are is as, and Shars. We are sitting in a recording studio that runs on commercial cloud infrastructure. Our podcast is distributed by platforms whose recommendation algorithms we do not control. The publication's website is hosted somewhere. We are not outside the supply chain we are describing. None of us is. If pretending otherwise would be its own form of bad faith.
I want to add one more thing about the longitudinal frame, because I think it matters. The four-quarter arc that the column traces is a real arc, and it really did happen. And the rhetoric really did shift in the way the column describes. But there is a longer arc that does not show up in the four-quarter window, which is, this is not the first time a development discourse has done exactly this. The exact same shape happened in the conversation about microfinance in the early 2000s, started with the language of empowerment and self-determination, moved through the language of partnership and synergy, ended with a sector that was, for a meaningful number of borrowers, a debt trap. The shape of the rhetoric, the substitutions of the words, the sequence in which the optimistic vocabulary displaced the diagnostic vocabulary, almost identical. So when I read the column this week, what I am reading is a very faithful description of a process the development sector has been through before, and the question that haunts me is, did we learn anything from the last time? Because if the answer is no, then the optimism is not just premature, it is a recurrence of a disease the sector knows how to recognize and chooses not to.
I want to push back on that comparison just slightly. I think the microfinance parallel is genuinely informative and the rhetorical shape is similar. But the substantive structure is different in one important respect, which is microfinance lending was a relatively contained financial product with a relatively well-understood failure mode. Infrastructure is a far more general purpose substrate. The failure modes are not yet well understood. The lock-in dynamics are stronger. The cost of switching, once an institution is committed, is higher. So while I take the rhetorical lesson from the microfinance arc, I would not assume that we know how this one ends just because we know how that one ended. This one might end worse.
I will accept that as a fair amendment. The shape is similar. The stakes are larger.
All right. We have been at this for a while, and I want to use the next break to take us into the part of the hour where we stop describing the discourse and start saying what we actually think the right thing to do. Because so far, we have largely agreed with the column's diagnosis. We have extended it in some places. We have noted some of its limits, ISS's point. But we have not staked out, ourselves, what we think the right position is. Let's do that next, next to that name. I want to start this act by putting a position on the table that I have been holding back, because I want to see what the room does with it. Here is the position. Here is the I think the column is right, that sovereignty has been redefined as procurement preference. I think the column is right, that the rhetoric has outpaced the material reality. But I think there is a step the column does not take that I would like us to take, which is, the language of sovereignty itself may not be the right frame for what is actually wrong here. Because sovereignty is a word that imagines the unit of analysis is the state, and a great deal of what is being lost in the I transition is not state-level authority. It is institutional autonomy at a much smaller scale. It is what the public university can decide for itself about its students' data. It is what the regional health system can decide about its patients' diagnostic records. Pardre, it is what the small newspaper can decide about its archives. None of those are sovereignty in the constitutional sense. All of them are what people actually mean when they say they want their institutions to belong to them. So my pushback to the column is, the word sovereignty is part of the problem, and not just because it has been hollowed out by procurement. It is part of the problem because it points the analysis at the wrong scale.
That is a position I have been circling around without saying out loud. I think you are right. I think the state-level sovereignty frame is the frame the partnership architecture is structured to deal with, because the partnership architecture is itself state to firm. So if you fight the battle at the state level, you are fighting it on terrain that is shaped to the firm's advantage. The institutional autonomy frame moves the battle to terrain the firm is less prepared for, because the firm cannot easily sign one master agreement that covers 1,000 mid-sized institutions. The institutional autonomy frame fragments the bargaining surface in a way the firm has to respond to one institution at a time.
I want to push on that because I think it is half right and half romantic. The institutional autonomy frame fragments the bargaining surface, yes, but it also fragments the bargaining power. And a mid-sized public university negotiating with a global cloud vendor on its own has worse leverage than the ministry negotiating on behalf of 40 universities at once. So the institutional autonomy frame trades centralized vulnerability for distributed weakness. That may not be a trade you want to make.
I think you can have both. The frame I have seen work in some contexts is institutional autonomy on the substantive questions, collective bargaining on the commercial questions. That is, the university decides for itself what its pedagogy is and what kind of system would fit its values. The consortium of universities negotiates the contract with the vendor on behalf of the institutions that have decided their pedagogies are similar enough. The frame is federated rather than centralized. It is also, importantly, not unprecedented. Library consortia have been doing this for decades for journal subscriptions. The journals try to negotiate institution by institution. But the libraries built consortia. The consortia got better terms. Or not. The same architecture is plausible for a procurement. It is just not what the current partnership architecture proposes, because the current architecture wants to negotiate state to firm.
That is a really important model, and I think it has been underexplored in our region specifically. The library consortium history is a concrete example of how institutions that individually had no leverage built collective leverage without ceding their substantive autonomy. And the lesson from that history that I think is most relevant. The consortia worked because the librarians who built them were technically literate about the terms of the contracts. The consortia were not negotiated by ministers. They were negotiated by people who understood the difference between perpetual access and access during the subscription period. So, if we are going to take the federated model seriously, the implication is, we need to invest, urgently, in the technical literacy of procurement officers and institutional administrators in the Global South. Not in ministers, in procurement officers. That is where the leverage actually lives. and that is the population that current eye development funding is least focused on.
Now I want to walk back something I said earlier. I said in Act 2 that the words are causal at the level of political feasibility. I want to revise that. I think the words are causal, but in a more specific way than I claimed. The words are causal because they shape what training programs get funded. What if the conversation is about partnership, you fund relationship managers and policy advisors, DR and pre and if the conversation is about sovereignty in the constitutional sense, you fund ministers' offices and white paper authors. If the conversation is about institutional autonomy and federated bargaining, you fund procurement officers and library consortia. The vocabulary is causal because the vocabulary determines what the development sector thinks it is buying. And right now, the development sector thinks it is buying partnerships when the thing it should be buying is procurement officer training. So my correction is, the word substitution we discussed is not just rhetorical cover. It is a misallocation of capacity, building money, building money.
That is an important walk back, and I want to make sure the listener heard it. You're now saying the words have a more specific causal role than you initially claimed. They're shaping what the development budget purchases.
Yes, and I think I undercounted that earlier. They cost, may being too cautious. The vocabulary problem is also a budget problem, and the budget problem is downstream of the vocabulary problem. The two are tightly coupled.
I want to register a concern about where this is going, though. Because we have just constructed a fairly elegant alternative to the state sovereignty frame, institutional autonomy with federated bargaining and a procurement officer training program. And it sounds very reasonable. And it sounds, though we have not yet asked whether it is actually more achievable than the state sovereignty frame, or whether it is just more pleasant to discuss. Because building a procurement officer training program across, say, all African public universities is not a trivial undertaking. It requires its own funding architecture. It requires curricula. It requires teachers. It requires a sector-wide agreement on what the standards are. It requires, in short, exactly the kind of cross-institutional coordination that the development sector has historically been bad at. So, I would like us to be honest that the alternative we are proposing is not obviously easier than the alternative we are critiquing. It is differently hard.
That is a fair check. Let me say what I actually believe with the proper hedging. I believe federated procurement, with technically literate procurement officers, is more achievable than full sovereign compute in a 5 to 10 year window in most countries in our region. I believe it is less achievable than the current partnership model in the sense that it requires more institutional work upfront. The trade is more upfront work, more durable downstream autonomy. Whether that trade is worth it depends on what you think the cost of the current trajectory is. If you think the current trajectory leads, in 10 years, to a public sector deeply locked into vendor systems with terms that get progressively worse as switching costs rise, then yes, the upfront work is worth it. If you think the current trajectory leads, in 10 years, to manageable dependency with reasonable terms, then the upfront work is overkill. I am of the first view, but I want to be transparent that the second view exists and is held by people I respect.
I want to use this moment to make a callback to something we discussed earlier, because I think it is the right place for it. We talked in Act 1 about the three columns of the honest accounting: gain, money, loss of autonomy, of loss of the federated model we are describing now is in effect an attempt to fill in column 3 with a specific institutional mechanism. The procurement officer with the technical literacy and the consortium behind them is the entity that is supposed to defend column 3. And one of the things I notice when I look at the optimistic literature is that there is no equivalent figure in any of those documents. There is the minister who signs. There is the citizen who receives IDN. There is the vendor who delivers. There is no institutional defender of autonomy at the layer where autonomy is actually being negotiated. That gap in the institutional architecture is exactly the gap our federated model is trying to fill.
That is the right frame. And it points to a version of the cost question that is more tractable than the abstract version. The question is not who pays for II in the global south. The question is who pays for the institutional infrastructure that defends the things II and the global south is currently being deployed to extract. Because if nobody funds that infrastructure, the extraction continues. And the institutional infrastructure that needs funding is procurement officers, library consortia, public interest legal capacity, regulatory technical staff. None of those are glamorous. None of them generate good photo ops. All of them are what the autonomy column requires.
Let me push on this, because I want to make sure we are not building a tower of abstraction. Give me a concrete example. I Ardia to first hay. One concrete example of an institutional defender of autonomy that exists somewhere in the global south right now and is doing the work we are describing.
I will give two. One is the digital rights organizations in Brazil that pushed back on the federal procurement contract for facial recognition systems in public spaces. They had the technical literacy to read the contracts. They had the legal literacy to challenge them. And they had the political coalition literacy to mobilize public opposition. The result was not a complete victory, but it was a substantial revision of terms in several jurisdictions. Two is the work of African language groups. Massacane is the one most often named, though there are others, who are building the data infrastructure for low-resource languages outside the framework of any single foreign vendor. They are not, on their own, building sovereign compute, but they are building sovereign data, which is a precondition for a different kind of model relationship later. Both of those exist. Both of those are underfunded relative to their importance. Both of those are more or less invisible in the development sector documents we have been discussing.
I want to add one I have been thinking about, which is closer to the procurement officer figure. There are some smaller initiatives. I am thinking of work in Kenya and in the Philippines, where civil society legal organizations have been training public sector lawyers specifically in the language of air procurement contracts. Not training them in AI broadly, training them in the very narrow domain of how to read a model as a service agreement and identify the clauses that matter for citizen rights. That is exactly the kind of capacity building that the federated model requires. And it is being done at very small scale by organizations that, again, do not have the kind of funding the partnership architecture has. So the model exists. The model is being underwritten by, in some cases, single-figure donor relationships. The model could be scaled. Whether it will be scaled depends on whether the development sector reallocates.
I want to pull on something here, because we have been describing a fairly hopeful institutional autonomy alternative, and I want to be honest about the part of this that I think the alternative does not solve. The alternative we are describing, federated procurement, procurement officer literacy, civil society legal capacity, addresses the contract layer. Jazz. It does not address the underlying capital concentration. The chips are still made in three or four places. The foundation models are still trained by a small number of firms with very large compute budgets. The ground truth of the global AI supply chain is not changed by better procurement contracts. So the federated model improves the terms of the lease. It does not change the fact that it is a lease, and I want us to be honest that we have, in the last 20 minutes, mostly been talking about how to negotiate a better lease.
That is fair. And I think the honest position is, the lease is the medium-term reality, and the work of improving the lease is the work of the next 5 to 10 years. But the long-term project of changing what is leased and what is owned is a different project that runs on a different timescale, and we should not pretend the first project is the second project. Improving the lease is not sovereignty. It is better leasing. Sovereignty, in the full sense, requires building the things being leased, and that is a 20 to 30 year project that almost no country in the global South currently has the capital architecture to undertake alone. The federated model does not solve that. The federated model is the medium-term defense, while the long-term project is, possibly, undertaken.
And the long-term project, I want to register, is not impossible. China did it. The history of how China got to the point where it has its own foundation models and its own chip ecosystem is a 30-year history of state-led industrial policy with an enormous amount of public capital and a lot of intellectual property strategy that the rest of the world considered illegitimate at the time and now considers, in retrospect, prescient. So sovereign A capacity at the full sense is achievable. And they achievable. It is achievable on a 30-year timescale with a particular kind of capital architecture. And most global South countries do not have that capital architecture. R is property. The ones that arguably do, India, Indonesia, Brazil, perhaps South Africa, are the ones the column is most cautiously optimistic about. So the picture is, for a few large states, sovereign capacity in the full sense is a plausible 30-year project. For the rest, the federated model is the realistic frame, and those two frames should be described differently, not blurred together under one word.
I want to invite a self-correction here, because I have been making an argument that I want to look at one more time before we finish. I said earlier that sovereignty is the wrong frame because it points the analysis at the wrong scale. I want to revise that slightly. I think sovereignty is the wrong frame for some countries and the right frame for others. And the conflation of the two is what produces the empty rhetoric the column describes. For Rhonda, the sovereignty frame is mostly aspirational because the underlying capital is not there. For India, the sovereignty frame is partially descriptive because some of the capital is there. The vocabulary error is to use the same word for both situations. So my revised position is, sovereignty is a real word with a real meaning that applies to a small subset of global South countries and is being inappropriately generalized to the whole. The federated autonomy frame is the more honest description for most.
I think that is right. And it is the kind of distinction the development literature should be making and is not. Because the literature treats the global South as a single category for rhetorical purposes and then deploys vocabulary appropriate to one slice of it across all of it, which is itself a kind of erasure. The honest accounting would say, for these five countries, the sovereignty conversation is meaningful at the constitutional scale. Or for these 40, the relevant conversation is institutional autonomy and federated bargaining. For these 20, even the federated conversation is currently out of reach on the immediate question grade contract terms. Three different conversations. The current vocabulary collapses them into one. The collapse is doing damage.
I will say one more thing, and then I will stop. The reason this matters to me, on a personal level, is that I have watched over 2 decades a sequence of foreign-led development priorities crash through our institutions and leave them less able to define their own purposes. Not less able to perform tasks, more able, in some cases, but less able to say what their purposes are, because the tasks have been defined elsewhere. The thing I am most afraid of with IE is that this is the most general purpose version of that pattern we have ever encountered. Because I is not one tool. It is a substrate that gets into how decisions are made at every layer. And once the substrate is foreign, the local conversation about purpose runs on borrowed grammar. That is the loss I am most afraid of, and I do not have a clean answer to it. I have the federated model, and I have hope that procurement officers can do more than they are currently asked to do. But I do not have a clean answer.
Let me hold that, because I think it's the place to take us into the close. The fear of losing local grammar for thinking about purpose, that is, I think, what sovereignty, properly understood, was always supposed to defend. And it is the thing that, the column suggests, the current vocabulary is least equipped to defend. We are at the part of the hour where I ask each of you the same question. What most changed about your thinking this week? Not a recap, not a recap, not a summary. Something specific you did not expect to say when we sat down. Take a minute each. Honest answers only.
What changed for me this week is something I did not articulate clearly until about 20 minutes ago in this conversation. I came in thinking the central problem was the gap between strategy documents and infrastructure, which is the column's argument and which I still believe. The what I did not see clearly until we worked through the procurement officer figure is that the central problem is also a misallocation of capacity building budget. The development sector is buying ministers and policy advisors when it should be buying procurement officers and consortium administrators. That is not a vocabulary insight. That is a budget insight. And it is the kind of insight that has actual implications for what I do tomorrow morning when I write a grant application. So what changed is, I have a clearer picture of where I have been mispitching my own work, and I think I am going to rewrite the next proposal in a way that asks for the unsexy version of the funding instead of the sexy version. We will see if it gets funded.
What changed for me is harder to name, but I will try. Why? I came in believing that the cost question, who is bearing the cost of imported I, was primarily a question about citizens whose data is being extracted. I still believe that, well, but the conversation made me see that the cost question has another bearer that I had been undercounting, which is the institutional autonomy of the mid-sized public institution. The university, the regional hospital, the municipal government, those institutions are losing something specific in the current trajectory, and the loss is not visible at the citizen level because it is upstream of the citizen. It is the loss of the institution's ability to define its own purpose. I had been thinking about this issue in terms of distributive cost, who pays. I am now thinking about it in terms of structural cost. What kinds of institutions are being made unable to govern themselves? The structural cost may be the deeper one. I am not sure yet, but I am going to be looking for it from now on.
I came in expecting to be the person who pushed back on the column for being too rhetorical and not concrete enough about alternatives. I did some of that pushing, but what changed for me is I am less confident now that the rhetorical critique is the wrong move, because over the course of the conversation, we discovered that the words are not just descriptive labels on top of a stable underlying reality. The words are determining what gets funded, what gets trained, what categories of institutional response are imaginable. So vocabulary critique, which I have always treated as a relatively soft mode of argument, turns out to have a harder edge than I gave it credit for. That is a substantive shift in how I read this kind of literature. I am going to take vocabulary more seriously in the future. I am still going to ask for receipts, but I am no longer going to treat the receipt as the only thing that matters.
What changed for me is something small and specific. I came in with the three-column accounting framework, gain, money, loss of autonomy, and I thought of it as a framework for evaluating individual deployments. After the conversation, I think it is also a framework for evaluating the literature itself, because what we noticed is that the optimistic literature and the critical literature each fill in only one column. The honest literature fills in all three, and there is, as far as I can tell, almost no literature in this space that does the full three-column accounting at the level of a specific concrete deployment. That is a research gap. It is the kind of gap that, if someone wanted to do useful work, they could fill. So what changed is, I think I see, more clearly than I did before, what a piece of work would look like that I have not yet seen, and I do not know if I am going to be the person who writes it, but I now know it should be written.
Thank you, all four of you. I want to say one thing briefly, before we close, because the question I asked each of you, I should also ask myself. What changed for me this week is, I came in believing the column's central claim, which is that sovereignty has been redefined as procurement preference, and I leave still believing it. But I also leave with a sharper sense of what my own publication is doing inside the discourse it is critiquing. We are not outside this. We use the same vocabulary. We sometimes do the same eliding. And the most useful thing we can do, going forward, is be specific where the rest of the literature is general. Specific about which procurement contracts. On my mind, apologet, in 1848 states. Specific about which institutional defenders are, or not funded. Specific about which countries the sovereignty word actually fits, and which countries it does not. Generality is what got us into the lease. Specificity is what would let us renegotiate it. That is my answer, and that is the hour. The spy to Minste Canersis Ferd and the American twos in Is, Problas or Nae, or Ist Tutulia is the weekly conversation from iNew Social, designed and edited by Dr. Diego Benila, with a cast of voices produced through Chatterbox on a single workstation. Next week we return to the table. For now, thank you for spending the hour.